Resources, and I am going to turn it over in a moment to our first speaker. We will have three sets of speakers and give orientating remarks. We'll then move to a section where I'll be talking about step-by-step approaches to leveraging resources for brownfields revitalization, and then the third part of the webcast will be the Assistant City Manager of Dubuque, Iowa, Terry Goodman, and the Director of Economic Development from Dubuque, Maurice Jones, talking about how they have been successful in leveraging resources for brownfields and community revitalization. We'll end up today with what we hope and plan will be about 30 minutes for Q&A. So with that, I'm going to introduce Patricia Overmeyer, the Coordinator for Land Revitalization for the EPA Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. Take it away, Patricia.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us. Again, I'm Patricia Overmeyer from the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization and EPA's headquarters office here in D.C. Today's webinar, as you probably know already, is about leveraging resources to promote community and brownfields revitalization. What is leveraging? We think of leveraging as the use of existing resources, including funding, to attract additional resources or funding. We promote at EPA the wise use of existing investments so that you can use those investments to lead to other additional funding investments to promote your community revitalization goals. Here at EPA in the Brownfields office, you may already be knowledgeable about our EPA Brownfields grant program. These are national grants. We provide direct funding for brownfields assessment, cleanup, revolving loans, and environmental job training. Our assessment grants are grants that can provide funding for you as the grant recipient to inventory your brownfields, characterize individual sites, assess sites, conduct planning and community involvement that's related to brownfields redevelopment and revitalization. We also provide cleanup grants. Cleanup grants can provide seed money for each grant recipient to carry out cleanup activities. Our cleanup grants are $200,000. So again, this is seed money. This is money that you can leverage to get additional funding. $200,000, we realize, is not enough money generally to clean up, to cover the entire cost of a cleanup. We also have revolving loan fund grants that can be used for seed money for cleaning up brownfields. Revolving loan fund grants enable states, different forms of government, Indian tribes, to make low-interest loans to carry out cleanup activities at brownfields properties. We also, here in the Brownfields program, have area-wide planning grants. These are grants that are provided to communities and nonprofits to research, plan, and develop implementation strategies for an area affected by one or more brownfields. Developing an area-wide plan can inform your assessment cleanup planning activities and to think through how you're going to use your brownfield properties to promote community revitalization. Again, leveraging. You want to leverage those area-wide planning grants, your planning resources, to think through how to bring additional funding to your brownfields revitalization activities. Also in the Brownfields program, we have environmental workforce development and job training grants. These grants are designed to provide funding to eligible entities, which include nonprofit organizations, to recruit, train, and place predominantly low-income and minority unemployed and underemployed residents in the areas of solid and hazardous waste impacted, in the areas of hazardous and solid waste management and skills needed to secure full-time sustainable employment in an environmental field. I'll add, at this point, to just remember that this webinar is not to speak about individual grant programs, but to speak about how, or to learn about how to leverage your individual community resources. Those may be brownfields grants, they may be your own investments, but today we're talking about leveraging. Because once you have a brownfield grant or you've made your own initial investment, you still may need funding, you still may face funding challenges as a community. There still may be funding needs, resource needs, in order to bring your vision to fruition. Cleanup costs often can exceed our individual grant funding. Remember, a brownfields cleanup grant is $200,000. So think of this as seed money that can help you to leverage additional resources. You may, when cleaning up a brownfield, in addition to cleaning up the brownfield for reuse, you may need resources for infrastructure upgrades, design and engineering, and redevelopment costs. So before you think through applying for brownfields grants or other sources of grants from the federal government or state governments, remember you need a plan. You need a plan for how you're going to use these resources together. How are you going to leverage one source of funding or one resource in order to attract other resources to your project? Remember that relying on outside funding without first thinking through how your own resources are going to be leveraged may set you up for issues right from the beginning. So you need to have a strong team, local leadership, a plan, a vision. We'll go through all those steps today, but think through how are you going to use your own resources wisely and use those resources to leverage and attract other resources to your community revitalization. You need a plan and a strategy for resources to be spent efficiently. You want to understand the restrictions and prohibitions on the funding sources that you may be going after. You want to have an idea of how resources can best be used in tandem and how you may need to set aside some resources as required for matching funds to leverage additional resources. So how did we get here? A little over a year ago, the National Brownfields Program put together a stakeholder meetings to solicit from our major stakeholders, our communities, our private industry partners, our other funders. We wanted to solicit for them how well is the Brownfields Program doing after 20 years. 2015 was the 20th anniversary of the National Brownfields Program. As part of that initiative, as I said, we did several stakeholder meetings. We also solicited comments via email, et cetera. We heard from many stakeholders that one of the number one priorities for them from our program is that we help our communities and other stakeholders think through and learn how to leverage resources, how to go beyond that brownfields grant. You get a $200,000 assessment grant or a $200,000 cleanup grant. You spend it. How do you get to the next point in your community revitalization program? So today's webinar is a kickoff for us. It's our first webinar after publishing our new guidebook. Our new guidebook is setting the stage for leveraging resources for brownfields revitalization. You can see on the slide the URL address for that guide. Many of you may already have seen it since it was advertised as part of this webinar. If not, there's the URL. Also, I'm sure if you Google EPA and leveraging resources for brownfields, you will be taken right away to the URL for the guide. If not, you have our email addresses. Feel free to ask us to send you a copy of the document. We also have to let you know that we have two other webcasts scheduled for as part of this series on leveraging best practices. And in those additional leveraging, we will be talking, we will provide presentations from other funders to help you think through how to use our funding in conjunction with other funding and how to leverage your funding and our EPA funding to attract additional resources to your projects. So today's webinar will concentrate on those initial steps you need to take to think through how to leverage your own resources and investments, how to build upon EPA resources, and we'll go through those steps. And then we'll also, today with us, we're very lucky to have some folks from Terry and Maurice from Dubuque, Iowa, who can talk through how they've used their resources and EPA brownfields grants to leverage other resources and to realize success in their community revitalization efforts. So with that, I'm going to send it over to Matt.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. This is Matt Ward from Sustainable Strategies DC, which helps local communities obtain resources for revitalization, which is what this webcast is about, leveraging resources for brownfields and community revitalization. And when we think of the word leverage and see the picture of the lever there on the slide, it calls to mind the quote from the ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who first described how leverage worked, and he said, "Give me a place to stand and a lever, and I will move the world." Those of us who work to revitalize brownfields know that the renewal of a brownfield can move a whole neighborhood. It can move a whole community. And likewise, we need to figure out how your first brownfields funding can be used to lift and move more funding and resources into your community revitalization. So I'm going to spend the next part of the webcast going over 14 key steps that you can use to leverage resources for brownfields revitalization projects. These 14 steps directly track the recommendations put out in the leveraging guidebook, which Patricia talked about, which EPA issued earlier this year. These steps are tried and true approaches to success that have been put to use in many brownfield communities, I'm sure in yours as well. What we're trying to do here is present them in a organized, step-by-step fashion so that you can take your resource leveraging efforts to the next level. Not every one of these steps must be employed for every brownfield project, but we suggest that these approaches tend to yield results, and hopefully this presentation can help you move a lot of resources for your community. Okay, step number one. You really need to have the right kind of team in place. That starts with leadership. If your mayor or county executive or borough president is not aware of what you want to do to turn a brownfield or vacant corridor around into new revitalization, then you're not going to be able to succeed in the other leveraging steps. So make sure that your leaders understand what you're trying to do and buy into it. But you also need a brownfields champion, that assistant city manager or economic development director or sustainability director who is willing to assume the role as a project manager to move this forward and handle all of the things that come with handling a complex project. That project manager and the local leadership should be backed by a cross-sector team. Brownfields are not just environmental issues. They're not just real estate issues. They're not just infrastructure issues. They're all of these things. And so you're going to need key stakeholders, not only from within your organization, but from outside. And you're going to want to keep those folks apprised of what's going on so that when the opportunity comes up to leverage resources, to ask for a grant, to ask your governor for funding, you don't have to go find those stakeholders and say, "Remember that project we talked to you about a couple of years ago? Well, can you help us on it?" They're going to be ready to help you because they're engaged throughout with a good project team. Okay, on to the next step. Brownfields is not about, well, let's fix a dirty site and figure out what to do with it later. You really need to begin with the end in mind. You should work with your community to develop a vision for how that riverfront or railroad corridor or dead factory or abandoned gas station fits into your broader community revitalization, housing, economic development, parks and recreation, cultural goals. You have goals for your community. How does that piece of property or that corridor and area of brownfields fit into what you'd really like to see your community become? And then you should articulate that vision for brownfields and articulate it with the team and with the stakeholders and with the organizations outside of your entity that are part of your brownfields team, so that when you're applying for funding, you don't say, "Well, I got a problem with a piece of road or a piece of sewer or a piece of land, and can you fix it?" You say, "Here's the vision for how we're going to create a new generation of economic revitalization that help people in need. This is what it's about. Oh, and we need money for infrastructure or for a brownfield." View these as opportunities for economic development, and that the brownfield is not a liability, but a way to get toward that economic development. So the only other point we'd like to say here is that sometimes we've worked with localities that say, yeah, I've got 92 brownfields, and we're going to try to figure out how to fix all of them. Well, it's difficult to handle 92 brownfields. It's difficult to handle 22 brownfields or 12 brownfields. Sometimes you have to really look at those sites that are going to have the most ability to move your community. Catalytic sites, catalyst sites that either are in a place that really needs to be cleaned up because they've caused public health or other issues, or can really be a game changer for changing that part of town or that corridor of development. And then focus on those, because you're not going to be able to do every brownfield at the same time. You can build on others later after you've had success on your priorities. Okay. Third is that in addition to your kind of core team that's going to carry this project, you need to have citizen and organizational support in your community, not at the end of the day after you've decided everything, but really engaged from the beginning. Early and frequent involvement in helping people to understand what you're envisioning for their neighborhoods, what they envision for their neighborhoods, getting them behind you, figuring out what kind of outcomes and benefits will come to that part of town, whether it be the neighborhoods or the business owners or the landowners, truly can propel you toward securing grants and securing funding. No grant maker is going to want to provide you dollars in a place where controversy, conflict, uncertainty, or a lack of transparency is evident. They're going to want to see that the neighbors, the business community, the environmental groups, they are behind you, and they want to fund you for that. So the traditional public hearings where people get to stand up for 5 minutes before a dais and say what they have to say and sit down without response may have a role in your land use planning, but that's not the best way to engage. You should think about community workshops, social media, a citizens advisory board. I know that David Lloyd, who is the head of the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, has said, when we see a grant application that says, if you give us money, we will start to form a citizen advisory board that will guide us on this, it's not a winning grant. You need to say, we have formed a citizen advisory board that is engaged, that backs this, and they're going to carry on no matter whether you give us funding or not, but you ought to give us funding. That's a winning grant application. So when you think about these citizens and stakeholders, don't forget the state and federal agencies, your elected representatives, making them part of these advisory boards and these efforts from the beginning, not just when you're trying to hit them up for a grant. Okay, so build and maintain that support.
Okay, just want to emphasize what Matt's saying. This is Patricia Obermeyer again. On that, remember, when you're trying to bring private dollars, development dollars to your project, just remember, as Matt said, nobody wants to invest dollars inefficiently. So don't wait and bring in and try to attract a developer when you don't have public support and public engagement already under your belt. Everyone wants to come in thinking their money is going to spend efficiently and go to good use, and they are not going to hold the responsibility of reducing controversy or bringing public engagement. They can help you, but you as the community need to invest your time and your resources into bringing your community together to support the project before the private dollars and private investment comes in.
Okay, number four, I view this as a very important step in leveraging funding and resources for your community revitalization. You need to break up your project into its different components and different aspects, and you need to break each component up into its individual phases in the whole continuum of redeveloping a brownfield or an area in your community. If you were able to get on an elevator with your governor and you said, we really want to clean up our riverfront and make it something better, and the governor says, okay, what do we do? Well, I'm going to need $50 million to do that from beginning to end. The governor will probably get off the elevator and say, that's too much. But if you say, you know, I need $100,000 for a visioning project to see how we're going to do that. And then later you come in and say, you know, now we just need some funding for the stormwater aspects of it, and We're going to need funding to plan that stormwater work before we actually construct that stormwater work. You're breaking the project up into bite-sized pieces. And so to use a couple metaphors about bite-sized pieces, first of all, there are components, and they're like a layer cake. Is a brownfield project a brownfield project? No, it's a trail project. It's a parks project. It's a waterfront project. It's a housing project. It's an economic development incubator. It can be all these different things depending on what your vision is. And each one of those different kinds of components have their own funding agencies, their own funding programs, their own funding sources. So you might not go to the U.S. Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration for stormwater funding, but you can go to your state environmental agency for stormwater funding. Your targets for funding, your targets for support really depend on breaking down the project into its core components, like a layer cake. To mix metaphors now, you need to look at the phases. And so a brownfield revitalization project may be a big, ambitious project, like eating an elephant. And how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. First, you're going to be doing planning. You might be doing site acquisition. You might be doing environmental assessments, cleanup. Construction may have multiple different phases and different areas where you focus your construction. Then you have operation of the project and the programs that go into that new community building or things like that. All of those are different bites of the elephant, and you have to break down what is the next $300,000 I need for the specific component of this project to move this project forward, not, hey, Governor, I need $30 million to get it done. Okay, so once you have those components and the phases of each component, it really makes a lot of sense. There's real value in trying to figure out what those will cost. So many times you'll be talking with a locality about a project, you'll say, well, what do you think that piece of infrastructure will cost so that we can ask funders to help support it? We don't know. We haven't really figured that out. It could be $1 million, it could be $1.5 million, it could be $2 million. Well, you don't want to talk to a funder without really having a good sense of what you really need to do in terms of the cost of a project. And this can be done in-house. You can done it with professionals. You can do it by reaching out to vendors and saying, this is not an RFP, but we're trying to get an idea about what it might cost for you to put in green infrastructure to deal with the stormwater down on the riverfront project. And this, we think it'll cost about $300,000. You can start to do that to really define the cost that you have, because without your components, without your phases, and without your costs, you cannot make a good ask to funders. So we move on to step number 6. Now you know what your projects are, what the components are, what the phases of them are, and what they cost. You can then start to identify the best kinds of funding, the best grants, the best incentives, the best subsidized loan programs, the best technical assistance that can help you bite off that next piece of the project and secure funding and move on. And so I would urge you to look at that third big bullet, which is the EPA Brownfields Federal Programs Guide. The folks here on the call that are moderating and presenting of it, you know, put this together every year or so, and it has dozens and dozens of different kinds of funding from primarily federal agencies that can go into your brownfields programs. But you can also look to state and regional funding agencies. You can look at philanthropy. There are community foundations. There are big national foundations. There are corporate philanthropies. Then you have to start to look outside of the public and philanthropic realm at the private sector investment and what redevelopers are going to be able to bring to the table, your bankers, your lenders, tax incentives. And we're going to talk a little bit more about your local funds and incentives. You start to kind of map out what are the different sources of funding that could go into this $1 million component of this big brownfield project, and you start to set your sights on those kinds of funding. Okay, so number 6 is find funding.
This is Patricia again. One thing I really want to emphasize here is that when you're thinking about your best mix of funding, don't forget to think about what you, the community, is going to bring to the table. Remember, folks want to invest where the local community has already shown leadership and dedication, and one way to show that is by dedicating some of your own investment dollars. So put your own money on the table, and people will be more willing to provide additional funding. Also, keep in mind when you're doing this plan that many federal funding sources, probably as well as state funding sources, require matching funds. So you are going to have to figure out how to make your own investments in your own project, both to make those matching funds and also to convince the rest of us who are willing to fund projects that you have your own money and your own skin in the game.
Absolutely. Okay, so you started to identify this whole mix of different kinds of resources that you could bring together. Well, then you really should go through a dedicated exercise of mapping out those resources, what we call a resource roadmap. Now, a resource roadmap might be for just one component or one phase of your overall brownfield project. You may have multiple roadmaps for different pieces of your brownfield project. So a resource roadmap is really just a document that identifies the different kinds of funding that can go into different components and map out their matching requirements, what the typical funding range is, what the application deadlines are, where you think you're competitive and where you're not, and then you can use that roadmap to hand to your state and federal funders and say, this is what we're trying to do to put funding together. You can give it to your city council. You can give it to your elected officials and say, this is what we're aiming for in the next 12 to 18 months in terms of raising funding, and people know what you're aiming at. So number eight, we've got our components, we've got our costs, we've got a roadmap of how we do that. You have to do what Patricia said. There are very few sources of funding from any state, federal, philanthropic, or other kind of funder that are going to give you that resource without a significant match or cost share. And you cannot wait until, you know, the grant application is due in 60 days, and by the time you get to your city manager, there's only 49 days. You say, I need $1 million through council right now. They're going to tell you maybe next year. You really need to, at the beginning, in the budgeting process and the capital planning process, before that grant comes out, secure your commitments, even if they're contingent. Look, I'll give you the $1 million if we get $1 million from the Department of Transportation. If we don't get the big grant, then I don't know if I can cover the whole bill. That's fine. Tell me that you'd be there for $1 million, city manager, if I could get another $1 million from the Department of Transportation. Consider all the resources you can bring. Often you're going to need cash, financial resources, but also in-kind resources can be put together can be put together to create your leveraging and cost sharing for a grant. So you won't get far without thinking about this early on. All right, step number nine. Sometimes, you know, eating an elephant gets you to a point where you've done lots of bites early on and you've gone through visioning and planning and design and engineering and upgraded some infrastructure, but you get to a point where you might need to build that $20 million incubator or theater or community center, and it's difficult to raise $20 million grants from anyone. It's difficult to raise local resources. Sometimes you need to think about, can we bond it? Can we use debt to finance it? Can we go to debt sources, and there's some listed there, that are subsidized or guaranteed, which brings down the cost of that? HUD, Federal Home Loan Bank, rural communities can get community facilities grants. Brownfield revolving loan funds can go into these things. You can't wait until that point when you're asking a funder to give you resources before you know whether you even have the capacity to use debt for a project. Capacity may have to do with things as basic as your ability to use revenue streams to service that debt. It may have to do with political capacity and political will for your elected leaders to be willing to do that. And it just makes sense early on to say, could we borrow $5 million? Could we leverage $15 million? And if you can only borrow $5 million through the capacity and political will that you have, that's a very different equation than $15 million, and it may influence the scope of what kind of other funding you're going for, the scope of the project, and the way you phase it. So think about that early on. All right, step number 10. All right, so you've got your act together. You know your project. It's based on a vision. You've got the components. You know the cost. You know the best funding sources for it. You know what your local skin in the game can be. It's time to start talking to people. It's time to start talking to funders and agencies and political leaders. And you don't want to put a 3-inch thick report on their desk. You don't want to put only your business card in their hand and say, now, I hope you remember this presentation we gave you. You want to have one sheet of paper. It can be front and back that tells the who, what, where, when, and why of a project, the key aspects of the project, the benefits that will come, our momentum, but also our needs, our funding requests, who you can contact for this. Make a briefing sheet. Make it attractive with before and after pictures. And use it to spread around. We've gone into meetings with funders to start talking about a project, and they pulled out a briefing sheet that we gave them a couple years before and say, I remember this project. I'm ready to fund. You want to distribute widely and often. And I'll just say one quick thing, that briefing sheet that's up there from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, they started with a $200,000 EPA Brownfield grant, and an hour before this webcast, they got a call from their U.S. Senate office, and they just got a $5 million Department of Transportation Tiger grant for their brownfield area. Briefing sheets can work. All right, number 11, states, you want them on board because they have resources, but even when it's federal funding, federal funders, philanthropic funders, banks will often look and say, is your state economic development office behind this? What does the governor think? Is this a priority in the state? That will make a big difference. So whether it's the state's funding or the state's backing, you really need to engage them, even if you're not going for a state grant. You're going for a foundation grant, a bank loan, having a governor or a state infrastructure chief behind you can make a world of difference. Okay, then if you want to talk with federal agency officials about their funding sources, you look at that EPA Federal Programs Guide for Brownfields, you can see all those patches. There's about that many funding sources from different federal agencies that can go into brownfields. And again, the key is don't call them up when that grant is due 19 days later. And can you talk with me about the project? Engage them as soon as you put that resource roadmap together. And, you know, eventually you're going to the Department of Transportation or you're going to the Park Service. You're going to these agencies and co-opt them, engage them in the project. They will give you guidance on what kind of funding applications make sense. They may give you technical assistance. They may visit your site. They may invite you to come in and meet with their colleagues or their superiors. And that's the kind of engagement that will make a difference when you're starting to apply for the funding. So collaborate early and often. Make them want to see you succeed because they're part of the project. All right. So number 13, you've got all these steps done. Well, you need to start thinking about grant writing. I will repeat, don't wait until that grant is due a couple weeks away to say, well, who's going to write these grants? Do we have a grant writer? Who are we assigning it to? Are we going to hire a grant writer? What is this grant about? We don't know the criteria. You need to get last year's grant copies or support from the agencies that you've been visiting all year to understand what the likely eligibility requirements, the competitiveness factors will be. You get your grant writer lined up. So when that state notice comes out that we have $10 million available for riverfront projects or that federal agency grant comes out, you are ready to go the day before it comes out. If you are in a situation where you've applied for one before and did not get it, then you can almost always get a debrief from the funding agency that explains, we liked your project, but here's an issue or a problem that we have. And you need to do that before the grant solicitations are on the streets, so that you can get open and honest assessments from your funders about what you need to do to fix the grant. So after you prepare for grant writing, we get to the last slide, and it is that nothing succeeds like success. You can have different levels of success. It's not just when that final ribbon cutting happens. It is when you make key achievements and progress. You might tear down a dilapidated building that has been plaguing the community for years. You might get a $100,000 grant from a foundation. You need to let all the funders that you plan to work with in the coming months and years understand this. Be at the celebration. Get a copy of the press release. Write them thank you notes. Invite them to the groundbreaking. Cultivate the media to cover this, because that will get funders excited about getting you to the next stage. There'll be happy smiles and more funding for the future. So if you put these 14 steps together in a logical and strategic fashion for your brownfields and community revitalization, you should be able to compete against anyone to get those resources.
Thanks, Matt. This is Patricia Obermeyer again, and I just want to emphasize public leadership, public investment, a vision, collaboration, and public engagement. And with that, we're going to turn it over to the folks at GU to give their story and talk about their experiences.
Okay, Terry Goodman is the Assistant City Manager of Dubuque, has been involved in the revitalization of that community in so many ways, including in their riverfront brownfields for a long time. And Maurice Jones, the Economic Development Director of Dubuque, is a key leader in making these things happen. So we're going to hear about how they have leveraged resources for brownfields and community revitalization on their Mississippi River waterfront. Take it away, Terry.
Thank you, Matt, thank you, Patricia. Maurice and I are very happy and grateful to be invited to this webinar today to share our story. And I can only say, first of all, that everything Patricia and Matt have said already, we didn't know. It's all true, and it's very useful. We sort of came upon it as we created a successful plan to redevelop our riverfront. And so Dubuque, Iowa, just by way of background, because our past is a forecast for the future, we're the oldest city in Iowa. We're located about 3 miles west of Chicago on the Mississippi River at the border of Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa. Our population is about 60,000, and we are part of the community of settlements on the upper Mississippi River that were basically French. The fur trade on the upper river was very important. It has a long history in the United States, but including in the upper Mississippi River. But we were a mining community, lead mining, manufacturing, and meatpacking. And what brought us to riverfront redevelopment actually was the downturn of the 1980s. And in the 1980s, Dubuque suffered terribly under the recession. We had the highest unemployment in the United States in 1983 of about 24%. We lost 8% of our population, and we had relied on two major industries for too many years and had not diversified our economic development portfolio. And so when John Deere reduced its workforce by two-thirds and the Dubuque Packing House closed in the 1980s entirely, we were left with a devastated economy. But the one thing that people can still do, even in hard times, is vision. And in the early 1990s, there was a community group called together by civic leaders, and we began visioning what the future might be, what we wanted to focus on, how we wanted to rebuild a community that frankly could have died in the 1980s. And the first and the most sort of promising opportunity we saw was our riverfront. And our riverfront, as you can see, was plagued with environmental issues. It was the home of former industries and manufacturers who used the river as a sewer. And that wasn't something, you know, unique to Dubuque. We went through about a 100-year period where people saw, you know, water as the answer to our pollution problems, and we would just dump into rivers, open dumping. There's a great book by John Norquist, the former mayor of Milwaukee, and he wrote the book called The Wealth of Cities, Revitalizing the Centers of American Life, and talked about revitalizing our waterfronts and riverfronts. And it certainly inspired cities like San Antonio, cities like Chattanooga, Tennessee, cities that we looked at and looked at for roles, models, and for leadership. So Dubuque began exploring the possibility of taking this blighted and scarred area on our riverfront and making it into something that would help us to reconnect our citizens and residents to the Mississippi River. The planning began with the visioning, as Matt had pointed out, and continued. These are just some of the sites of the brownfields that we were faced with as we began trying to imagine what the future of our Mississippi River in Dubuque would look like. The interesting thing about federal monies is that federal and state monies typically like to be last dollar in. There are few federal grant programs that want to be first dollar in or that can be first dollar in, and EPA brownfield funding is just exactly that kind of funding. The challenges, I think, that we faced as we looked at our 120-acre waterfront included cleanup from hazardous waste and petroleum contamination. We had tanks on the river. We had vacant industrial sites on the river. And we actually had fire burning from lumber yards of a century ago. This whole wetland by the river was a lot of sawdust that would just catch fire as people would walk on these sites. Excuse me. When we began looking at the North Port, we understood that we had to first make the ground ready for any kind of redevelopment. What we envisioned included a conference center, obviously hospitality space because it is a riverfront, a river walk, burying our flood wall, creating a brewery and an amphitheater on the riverfront, and then building the largest river interpretive center in the country, the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, that revisioned our look at water and the river as resource. The North Port's revitalization in the North Port was 90 acres that needed to be redeveloped. And the Brownfields funds were some of the first money in. We were able to then leverage private donations and state investment in the riverfront as a result of the Brownfield cleanup that we did. The funding for the first phase of the program, it was a $188 million project that has grown since that time to include $500 million plus of investment. Excuse me. Here's some of the grants that we were able to receive as a result of the riverfront planning and redevelopment that we implemented. The Institute for Museum and Library Services, the Economic Development Administration, the EDA. We were able to secure funding from HUD. From the Department of Interior, we received funding for National Fish and Wildlife Interpretive Center in the museum. And we also received funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the formerly known as Scenic Byways grants that now are funded through the federal government through the state of Iowa. Those are some of the funding grants that we were able to secure in the process. In addition, there was between $20 and $30 million in private investment and then development that occurred.
Right. Additionally, what you'll see is we also received state resources as well. $48 million in grants from Community Tourism Vision Iowa. And what we found from some of our visioning sessions was how much the community wanted to reconnect with the river. And so we saw this as an opportunity to actually look at it from a tourism perspective. With the addition of the Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, with the hotels, with other activities, with the marina, we were able to begin to create an attraction component to the North Port, and it far exceeded our expectations to this point. Private sector investment, such as FlexSteel, basically wanted to become a part of this revitalization. McGraw-Hill, another local employer, also has invested very heavily within the Northport area. What that's done is that's created an opportunity to create traffic in the community, and it's changed the public's perception about the Northport and, again, reconnecting people back to the community. This private investment was something that we never imagined would reach the level that it has. But what it has also done was begin to spur other conversation about other opportunities within the Port of Dubuque.
The Northport today, it has experienced great success. It is currently the greatest tourist destination in the state of Iowa. Some of this goes back again to the visioning that we began in the 1990s and the desire of people to get to know the river again, to be reintroduced to the river as a resource and as some place to both recreate and enjoy, but also a place to treasure and conserve. So the riverfront today hosts the largest museum, as I said, in the country, that is devoted to telling the story of the Mississippi River. It has boat docks, amphitheaters, it has hotels, and it also includes business development. What McGraw-Hill, we learned from Terry McGraw that when they were looking to rebuild in Dubuque, and they could have gone to development parks on our far west side and to Greenfield or to the south side, he allows his employees to vote for the location of their choice in the community when they're rebuilding a new office. And his employees voted to have the office building built down by the riverfront. So this spurred other private investment by McGraw-Hill, by FlexSteel, and by other businesses. So it's a real mixed-use space. It's a place of festivals. It hosts literally millions and millions of visitors every year. And it has really reconnected not just Dubuque to the city, but our riverfront to our main street. It also spurred, money begets money, and it spurred reinvestment in our downtown. So now that our main street has seen a reinvestment of over $200 million. And then it led to other successes. The historic Millwork District in Dubuque was an abandoned million square feet of space from years ago when Dubuque was the site of the largest millworking district in the country. The abandoned space we saw not just as a challenge, but as an opportunity. As we looked for more workforce housing in our community, this space was ideal for a transformation.
Southport, in the photograph you'll see, is just to the left. And we see this as an opportunity. Where there's challenges, there are always opportunities. And what we wanted to do from our conversations with our citizens was to how do we connect the Northport to the Southport in just a dramatic way as well. So we've been awarded a $200,000 EPA Brownfield Area-Wide Planning Grant, and we've essentially put the same model that we've done in the Northport as we've done on Main Street, Historic Millwork District, and begin to start that process within the Southport.
And as Maurice pointed out, it's all about replicating the model that Matt pointed out to you earlier. It's about creating a team of leaders across different sectors, the private, the public, and the nonprofit sector. It's really important to have that team. It's about engaging stakeholders. As Patricia mentioned earlier, don't wait until the last minute to engage the public, to be transparent in the planning session, to seek input from every sector, to make sure that, frankly, every community leader, whether it's the banker or the church leaders or a youth group, that there's a genuflection made and that their input is given as you go about the planning process. So we say people, the leaders are critical, planning is critical, and partnership is critical. And also you'll find as you're writing grants, performance measures are important. So we are really big about measuring success and measuring the project as it goes forward. One time a funder told us as we were raising roughly $200 million for the first phase of the riverfront redevelopment, you know, money does beget money, but also the private sector funds will leverage public sector, then public sector leverages additional private, and on and on, so it's sort of private, public, private, public, private, public. the brownfields money are so important, as I said before, because they can come in first. They can be some of the first dollars in. It shows the commitment on the public sector side, both at the federal level, the state level, and the local level. And then it also attracts those investors that are so critical to moving the project forward, whether they're philanthropic and donors or actual economic development investors.
Private investors. And that's what we've done with our Southport area very specifically, is after going through public charrettes, talking with local leaders, we begin to engage the private sector. That's such an important role in this process. And after a lot of communication, a lot of education as to what this can mean, we developed a win-win concept. The local private entities that actually have a lot of property in the Southport actually have joined the development team and have begun to work with us on trying to vision what can happen in the Southport area. And this is one of the concepts that has come up.
Maurice, this is Patricia Obermeyer. Sorry to interrupt, but folks are having a little bit of a hard time hearing you. Could you get closer to your speakerphone or speak up a little loudly? Thanks, more loudly.
We'll bring the phone over. So what you have in the Southport is just one concept right there on your screen. And this is after meetings with the property owners, with the city, and with various stakeholders about how can we begin to capture what the community wants to see for revitalization of the Southport.
So again, the keys to success that Dubuque experienced included strong leadership, the engaged citizenry, planning, people planning and partnerships, the municipal investments. The city had to be a partner in this from the get-go, as did the business and private sector developers, as did the nonprofit sector. So we made a plan that the planning, it took years, not, you know, just weeks and days, it's years, and then we identified our potential donors, and that included government granting bodies, but also nonprofit grants and local donors. It required relationships at all levels of government. We regularly communicated with our state legislators, with our partners here in the county of Dubuque, but also with all of our federal partners, including our elected officials and the federal agencies and administrations that were providing grants for a variety of purposes. I think one thing I learned through the process of raising these funds, which we did for the first phase of the Northport, and that was about $200 million, is that we started out and we didn't limit ourselves in our visioning, and we didn't scrimp and save in the planning phases, the feasibility studies, the initial conceptual designs and design development. We made sure that we planned everything so that we could answer every question a potential donor or investor would have. And we always believe that there's always funding. There's funding everywhere, but this planning is so critical to success, and the partnerships and the transparency. So we felt those were the keys to our success, and the Brownfield funds were absolutely essential.
I would just add one more thing, and that is, you know, there's constant communication, not just to the public, but to your partners, and whether it's private or other public entities as well. And no plan was ever made in a vacuum. And so we never, ever tried to do something without making sure that our partners were on board. And that has been the key to not just the success in the Northport, but as we begin to envision what we're going to do in the Southport, it's a constant communication about ideas, about leveraging not just dollars, but ideas as well, so that we can create something that is visionary for our community.
Okay, wonderful job, Terry and Maurice. It's fantastic to hear about Dubuque and the story of how you've done this over the years and are still doing it and are making it a model for revitalization. This is Matt Ward, and I'm back live. I'm in the room with Patricia Obermeyer, so we're here together to answer questions. As Michael said at the beginning of this webcast, if you type in the Q&A field there. We can get your questions. We're going to be looking at them here on our screen, and we will answer most all of them verbally. So we have a question here about tips for leveraging that may be unique to small rural community projects. And I actually live in, I work in Washington, D.C., but I live in a community of 5,000 in West Virginia that has leveraged about $20 million around their brownfields work, actually $20 million in public sector money and about $100 million in private sector investment. And so what I will say is that the 14 steps that are in this webcast work for a small town just as well as it works for Philadelphia or Chicago or Los Angeles. You need to get local leadership. You need to get the backing of your community. You need to put together a team. You need to articulate a clear vision. The little towns, the small rural places that we've worked with have articulated visions that are unique to them, that may not be what Seattle or Miami have as their vision, but are unique to them. And you go through the 14 steps and finding those phases and talking with your state and federal partners. All of that makes sense. What may be unique for smaller rural communities are the following. One is you probably have much less ability to leverage your own resources into the game. You may have limited ability to bond or to borrow or to service the debt that may come if you're doing a large-scale project. And so you're going to have to be that much more proactive in going to your state government and helping them understand what you're trying to do and why they need to put more skin in the game. The community I talked about in West Virginia got not one but two U.S. Department of Transportation Tiger grants that went through the middle of their brownfields. They could not handle the match on their own. They went to their state DOT and got the state DOT to basically cover the gap in their matching. So that's one thing, is that the leveraging and the matching and the cash that you can raise may not be what Philadelphia can raise. The second thing that is unique with smaller rural communities is that you may not have as hot of a market for your brownfield, meaning if you had once a colleague of mine said, there are no brownfields in Manhattan. Now, there may be contaminated sites in Manhattan, but that land is swooped up and built with multi-million-dollar real estate deals faster than you can blink. That might not happen in a rural community where the markets are weaker and you're not going to attract that private sector development the same way. That's when you need to get more creative in reaching out to the private sector community and seeing if they will back you and finding other developers, other users to bring in. So you can look at the leveraging guide to talk about matching and developing private sector support, or you can contact us and we can talk more about it. Okay. So I see another question that is, can someone speak to the issues related to attracting private sources of funding for these sorts of projects? Does anybody want to tackle that? I think I'll tackle it, but I think Maurice and Terry should also tackle that because they had much more private sector investment than the public sector investment. So let me just start, and then Dubuque, you take it over. Again, you need to be working with the private sector early on, whether that be the Chamber of Commerce or your industry association or your manufacturing association, to start to figure out how you can shape a project that will be attractive to the private sector when you get to those stages. Likewise, why not put the local banker or the lending agencies on your stakeholder task force that does this so that they can be part of the thinking about this from the beginning is one thing. And then I would say what everybody knows about development. Development goes to places where they see some certainty in their investment. If they don't know whether contamination will come back and bite them because you haven't done good work with your assessment grants to tell them how to handle potential pollution, that uncertainty may drive away investment. If they say, what about an upgrade of the road and the sewer and water, and you say, well, the city hasn't thought about that, about how to upgrade the infrastructure, that uncertainty will drive away investment. If they say, what does the governor or the state economic development office think about us doing this? Can you get them behind us? You need to say, yes, we've talked to them. They agree with our vision. They can get behind us. So those kinds of certainty and working with private sector stakeholders early on is what will make it more likely that you can attract their investment. Dubuque, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, Matt, I would concur with that. I think one of the things we also take a look at is creating that whole win-win scenario. And it's really identifying opportunities where private sector can actually look at their bottom line and see a benefit. They also see that the city and other stakeholders are willing to play a role and that there is a long-term plan in place. And so that means other ancillary development, that means other partners are willing to step to the table and maybe address or alleviate some issues. And by putting that on the table up front, that encourages not just one or two parties to invest, but that encourages an environment for investment into your project.
And just one more note from my perspective, having worked as a development director in my past life, everyone needs to be a part of the visioning. As Maury said, you know, I think the folks in the community who are in a position to invest either in a private sector development or be a part of a nonprofit development, don't want you to come to them with the plan already made and say, here, can you find a role for yourself here, or do you have an idea, or will you give us money? No, you want to go to them in the planning and visioning phase, whether they come to a public meeting or whether you go to them personally and say, here's what people are looking at, talking about. What do you think about this? How could this help, you know, your business? How do you see yourself in this, involved in this project? I mean, and it's time-consuming, but it pays dividends in the end, and it's not just about money. We found that people absolutely want to be involved and a part of a vision that's bigger than themselves, and I think this holds true for every community, large or small, in every part of our country. People are not inspired by small dreams, and we know, you know, someone said that. It's not original with me, but we found that to be so true that if folks are involved in the planning and the visioning, if they demonstrate support for it and with their ideas and their kind of participation in a dialogue, they're definitely going to be involved in helping to fund it in some way or to enhance the project in some way by developing something alongside the vision. So I just think that's so critically important to go in with the belief that every person has something to contribute and it isn't money. Start with the ideas, start with their engagement. If they tell you they think your project looks like, a joke, then, you know, take that and say, well, what would you do with it? We changed the entire exterior of a building because enough community leaders at just a regular engagement session said, you know, why are you putting this kind of porcelain on? This is used in San Francisco. Our contractors like copper. It's a natural material. It's indigenous. Let's do this. So, you know, it's just amazing how people want to be engaged and not just with money.
That buy-in is absolutely crucial to success.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, Dubuque. We have a next question. I'm going to throw it to Patricia Obermeyer at EPA. There was a question about brownfields redeveloped into sites for urban agriculture. Patricia.
Yes. Yes, there are some great examples of brownfields that are redeveloped for urban agriculture. The city of Chicago has several sites. Toledo has done it. Huntington, West Virginia, has a site. We're currently working with Dover, Delaware, to find a way to use one or more of their brownfield sites for urban agriculture. And we also, to help you out, we do have a tool. The EPA Land Revitalization Program has a tool labeled Brownfields and Urban Agriculture. guidelines for safe gardening practices that can walk you through. It includes a tool and a think-through piece on how to turn your brownfield into an urban agriculture success. And we will post in just a minute the URL to find the fact sheet that includes the link to that tool.
Excellent. An old...
You were on mute, sorry.
Huntington, West Virginia has an old suit-making factory. They made men's suits and 450,000 square feet. The factory closed, went overseas, has been vacant for a long time. It has now been put back together by a nonprofit to train out-of-work coal miners from southern West Virginia and new skill sets, including as being solar roofing technicians, craft furniture makers, and there's a whole section of that innovative brownfield redevelopment that is training niche farmers in specialty crops to go back to their communities and take reclaimed coal mines and put that into urban agriculture and community agriculture. The training center, the old suit making factory, is a brownfield. They got EPA, Environmental Workforce Brownfield grant money to train folks in this. The site itself is a brownfield, and the places where they're going to be putting new jobs and business enterprises are a brownfield as well. Okay, there's another question about out-of-the-box funding sources, and we could talk, we'll give another webcast about out-of-the-box funding sources someday, but just a couple quick mentions. One is, if you look at the public agencies that give grants and other funding, you may find some surprises. I mean, we all know infrastructure comes from your state Department of Transportation. We all know that, you know, your state environmental agency might do sewer and water. But did you know that the National Endowment for the Arts is putting funding into brownfields, helping do civic design that is beautiful and iconic, instead of just building back very gray and boring kinds of redevelopment? We see the Federal Home Loan Bank system, which you may think from their name and homes, only does financing for homes, but they have a community investment program that can put money into community facilities. The Federal Home Loan Bank system did a $20 million low-cost loan and a $5 million grant to, sorry, Terry and Maurice, to Des Moines, Iowa, you know, in your state of Iowa, for development of a 300-acre brownfield in downtown Des Moines. I'm going to mention one other that is not a public funding agency. It's the National Development Council is a nonprofit funder and financer of distressed communities, and they have done about 100 public-private partnerships where they put together private sector resources with the public sector to do brownfields revitalization, community facilities. They have their own bonding tool, the National Development Council, called the 6320 Bonds. It's like a low-cost, nonprofit-driven bonds. And they're doing deals all over the country. So I'd urge you to look on the web for the National Development Council. And I am working with them in several brownfield communities across the country. So there's a few out of the boxes.
Okay, our next question has to do with, does anyone have any examples of success where communities have used crowdfunding for brownfield projects? I do not, off the top of my head. I'm sure if potentially could be successful, but I don't know if Iowa, the folks from Iowa, are you aware?
No, we're not, but I suppose it's an idea.
So this is Matt Ward, and I have had some experience working with a group called Citizen Investor. It's like the word citizen and the word investor pushed together, Citizen Investor. And you can look them up on the web, and they specialize in crowdfunding on community development projects. Not all brownfields. You know, you want to build a dog park, you want to build a riverfront trail, you want to do an urban forestry project or a public art project, they will help you come into your community and crowdfund around that community revitalization project. And we have not yet done it, but we're working with a community in Connecticut that would like to crowdfund with Citizen Investor for the revitalization of a brownfield area. What I would say is that I do not have experience in big national crowdfunding that may raise bigger dollars, but in my experience with local crowdfunding, you're not going to raise $1 million from a crowdfund, but if you needed to do a $25,000 visioning session, or you want to hire an architect to draw the visuals of what your redevelopment would look like and you need some cash, that level of funding for those types of kind of planning and visioning probably are appropriate for crowdfunding. Okay.
I would agree, Matt.
Yes. Okay, do we have another question? Has anyone? No. Okay.
Okay, there is a question from a gentleman that we, during the presentation, we mentioned the need to address toxic hazards. And the question is, are there excellent federal or other websites that are specific to communicating with affected communities about toxic issues? EPA does have on its website excellent guides for how to do community engagement with regard to all kinds of hazards and contamination. You may want to try our website at www.epa.gov/superfund/community-involvement-tools-and-resources, and we'll post that URL in the chat box for you, so you could try that. I don't know if Matt or Maurice and Terry, do you have other suggestions?
The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, ASTDR, which is a federal agency that works with toxic substances, does an annual grant program that helps communities deal with neighborhoods or areas that are being impacted by toxic substances that may be harming public health or causing neighborhood concern, and they use these resources for, among other things, to help you organize the community to come up with a vision for how to turn one of those toxic sites, a brownfield, around. It's not a lot of money. It's only one program, but it has done that kind of work. So I would recommend that you look at ASTDR.
That is the only one that we've looked at, Matt, so that's a good source.
Okay. All right, Patricia, do we see any other questions up there? Keep the questions coming.
One caller or one person is asking if we have good examples of multiple site corridor projects that include blighted properties as well as brownfields, especially in communities of need. EPA does have on our website examples of our area-wide planning grantees and their success stories, and every single one of the area-wide planning grantees' success story has a link to their individual website for their success in area-wide planning. Our area-wide planning grant program provides funding to communities to do plans around brownfields and other blighted properties that are associated in the same area or neighborhood of a community. So I would suggest that you check out the area-wide planning website for some suggestions and some good information.
Yes, there's excellent information about broad areas that have multiple sites. I'll note that the EPA has an open round for area-wide planning grants right now. You have until August 10th to submit an application. That's not far away, but there's still time for that. And I'll also just make a comment that, you know, a brownfield has a specific legal definition in federal law. And, you know, we're really talking about that here today. But where you find brownfields, properties that are impacted by real or perceived contamination, you're likely to find blight as well, which may just involve dilapidated housing or dilapidated buildings that may not pose the same kind of risk from hazardous substances or petroleum contamination that makes it, an official brownfield. There are good examples, including in those area-wise, where if you're going to clean up two or three or four brownfields in along a railroad corridor or a riverfront or in a particular neighborhood, you're going to have to deal with those blighted structures as well. Okay.
I just want to ask, Matt.
Yes.
I'm sorry. If I could.
Go for it, Terry.
I think Dubuque was successful in receiving one of the EPA's Smart Growth Achievement Awards for the Millwork District in the Washington neighborhood area. And I think that looking at some of those projects that the EPA has recognized around the country, you'll see those kinds of projects specifically receiving awards, because they're not that uncommon.
Okay, we have a few more minutes left for Q&A. We're looking up on the screen to see if we have any more. Keep them coming. We'll answer a few more. Okay, we have another question. Okay, we've recently been approached by a gas pipeline company about what we would like to see them handle the area near to our community. Just give us a second on the question.
Can we work alongside them?
Right. So if I understand the question correctly, there's a gas pipeline company, and they may be investing or coming through your community. How do you do economic development or property revitalization around them? Certainly every partner, particularly partners with resources that is looking to invest in your community, is a good partner and will help you leverage resources. I worked with a town in New York that was right on the edge of the Long Island Sound, and a big electric company wanted to bring an underground electric line through the Long Island Sound for electricity planning purposes, and it had to land somewhere, and they wanted to land it near a brownfield in this town in New York, and the mayor of the town said, I'm building a $25 million LEED Platinum Community Center, and I'm about $7 million short, and I think you should help me build that community center, and guess what? They got $7 million. He was a good negotiator. So I can't promise that every partner that you work with will give you $7 million, but you should certainly see how you can leverage their resources. Okay. Here, what kind of tax breaks do some of these sites receive? Okay, so unfortunately, the tax incentive that was created by the Congress for brownfields themselves, for depreciating the cost, for accelerated depreciation of the cost of the cleanup, which was very helpful, died in Congress, three, 4 years ago? And folks have not been able to get them to pick it back up. Always told, well, we want to do a comprehensive rewrite of the entire tax code, and so you could be part of that, and, oh, we're still holding our breath for a comprehensive rewrite of the entire tax code. So won't say anything about that, but I will say that the New Market Tax Credit Program brings out about $1 billion a year in tax credit allocations to what are called community development entities, which can be banks usually, but a whole variety of tax credit community development entities, and those funds can go into revitalization projects in distressed areas. You know, a brownfield is often revitalization project in a distressed area. And new market tax credits are very complicated. You're going to need professional help to put those applications together, but they essentially provide Wall Street with a big tax credit that ends up turning into a grant that can be $2, $3, $5, $10, $15 million for your project. So that's a very simple discussion of a very complex tool, but that's going on right now. We know that we have tax credits that are available for many state economic development offices. I'm doing a brownfield project in a community that the state provided a 25% income tax credit for the cost of the project through their tourism tax credit, because this redevelopment is going to be a water park and tourism area that's going to bring tourism. So there's a whole variety. The only other thing I would say, and it's a big subject that we won't get into in a lot of detail, but tax increment financing is not really a tax credit. It is a tool by which a locality that has authority under state law to do this can get bonds to pay for the upfront cost of a redevelopment based on the future tax revenues, the tax increment that are projected to come from the upgrading of that area. That future tax revenue can service bonds that you can get up front. It's being used in nearly every state. It's been a big success in brownfields. So I would say that if you go to the EPA 2015 Brownfield Federal Programs Guide, it has a whole section on tax incentives and tax tools that can go into brownfields. And Patricia just posted that to everybody in the chat box. Okay.
Can small communities bundle an application for new market tax credits?
I know enough about new market tax credits to be dangerous, but not all that more. What I will say is that it must be in an eligible area. So if you have rural town A beside rural town B, and rural town B is not an eligible area because of its demographic and economic distress, then you're not going to bundle together. The second thing is that it must be for eligible activities, which are typically job-creating activities. So, I did talk with new market tax credit lenders about doing a police station on a brownfield in a community, and the message back was basically that police stations are very important, but they're not going to create any jobs. You're going to move those cops from old station A to new station B? No. If you have an eligible area with an eligible project, an eligible investment, and you have a community development entity that's willing to make the investment there, that's what matters. I don't think that you can normally bundle across multiple projects. It's a project-specific investment. Okay. What types of additional resources or opportunities for brownfields redevelopment at the community level are likely to be created?
By pending legislation.
By pending legislation.
This is Patricia Overmeyer. There isn't much in the way of pending legislation at this moment. There are two separate bills for brownfields to reauthorize the brownfields program in Congress. There's a Senate bill and a House bill. Both have been passed by the individual chambers. However, they're not, there's no unique or different funding mentioned in either. Basically, both bills just allude to allowing the EPA Brownfields program to have authority to provide grants to certain properties such as waterfront properties or port properties or small communities. However, although these are mentioned in both pieces of legislation, we already have the authority to provide that kinds of those grants to those types of communities. So I, at this time, do not know of any legislation that would provide new funding opportunities. It's just a reauthorization of the brownfields program with mention of types of brownfields and brownfield sites that we already have the authority to fund.
I will say that the BUILD Act, which is the acronym for the brownfields legislation pending in Congress, does also change some of the rules and allow for larger grants to be given than the typical EPA $200,000 grants. Also provides that EPA may give multi-purpose grants that are basically assessment and cleanup grants bundled together, which is something that EPA has used existing authority to do in one round about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. So it may encourage that. No other specific brownfields funding, but remember at the beginning when I said, what is a brownfield project? It might be a trail, it might be a park, it might be a business incubator, it might be a green infrastructure for stormwater project. It might be a lot of different things. There are bills pending in Congress to support the Economic Development Administration and bringing back new manufacturing. There are bills in Congress to help revitalize the Appalachian region, where coal mine and coal sector industries are dying and people are out of work. There are pieces of legislation about specific pieces of infrastructure, water, sewer. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell promised that in the first week of September, when Congress reconvenes, they will take up the Water Resources Development Act, which is the Corps of Engineers funding bill for riverfronts and lakefronts and ports and waterways, which often you'll find brownfields there. So, that's why you need to do a resource roadmap as a specific conscious action in your funding scheme so you can start to reach out and find those sources and put them into a strategy. Okay. We are about at our time of being done. We're going to see if there's any one or two last questions. And if there are, we may contact you directly to answer these things. Please look at the resources that EPA has been posting as we go along here and questions. Please look at the CLUIN webinar site where there were some resources posted before we started today. And we are very pleased that we had 400 people on this webcast. Stay tuned when we put out more information about the next round of Leveraging and Meet the Funders webcast series that we'll be doing in October and later in the year. We need to get a few details confirmed before we post those, but there's going to be more of this coming. Patricia, do you have any parting words for all those who want to go out and get their levers and start lifting up lots of money?
I just want to reiterate that, remember, local leadership, collaboration, public engagement. Think through where your resources are available, how to corral those resources and leverage them before you seek other funding assistance from the federal government and your state. But also always reach out to your state and federal partners for assistance, for guidance. Please check out the EPA Brownfields and Land Revitalization website. We have a ton of information and guides and guidance, including the guide, the leveraging guide that we put together as the subject matter for this webcast. Please look at that guide for leveraging brownfields resources and use that and take the steps that we outlined today so that you can leverage your own resources. But remember, invest your own resources, corral your own resources, do public engagement, and launch your program from within before you seek funding assistance from the outside. As a funder, I can tell you when we read applications for funding, the first thing we look for is a vision from the community, dedicated resources from the community, and leveraging capability. We get a lot of grant applications in every year, and we really want to choose grants that are going to be successful. And the keys to success are local leadership, public engagement, stakeholder involvement, collaboration. We want to hear your story. We want to see your vision when we read your application. So with that, I know we've gone over a little bit but on time, but we thank everyone for calling in and being a part of our presentation today. You have our individual email addresses. Feel free to follow up with additional questions if you want, or if you didn't get some of the resources that we mentioned, please feel free to email us, and we'll be glad to provide you with the information. So again, and thank you so much to folks from Dubuque, Terry Goodman, and Maurice Jones. Thanks for your participation, your insights, and your personal experiences.
All right. That's it, everybody. Over and out.